Blog Talk Radio.
All aboard! The Clio Exchange Express is leaving the station. Welcome to the Clio Exchange Express, a conversation about the past, present, and future. A lively discussion between friends, family, pundits, personalities, and potentates, if necessary, in order to teach and learn something new. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the hour. Let's go to the show already in progress.
A continuation of something that was started last week, and we were excited last week, and now to get into the second half of it, I tell you, we're just over the moon, and I'm not coming alone, because our whole effort, as you know, is that we want to take you on a journey that will educate, inform, and inspire, and in a lot of cases, that require more than one voice, and that second voice that's coming along before we bring out our music guru is John Cheatham. How are things in London Town, John?
Hello, Lee. Hello, hello, listeners. It's very, very cold. That's all I can say.
I hear you, brother.
England has a we've got this arctic weather, you know, that's hit over here. Well, it's cold.
Mm-mm-mm. I'm telling you. So cold temperature-wise, and is it also wet?
It's always wet.
Oh.
So that makes it even worse.
Yeah.
Cold and wet.
Yeah, when you said that, you know what popped in my mind was A Foggy Day in London Town. Billy Stewart, right?
Yeah, back man. Then, yeah.
Always yeah. wet. Well, listen, we're going into the second half of this great discussion with our music guru, John, and are you as excited about the unveiling of that part of the
Because last week was wonderful. It was truly wonderful, you know. So let's continue.
All right. Well, with that, John, let's go ahead and get this special excursion underway and set it up for another visit into our music archives and bring our music guru to the microphone and see what he's got for us that's new. But before we do that, I'd like to let our listening audience know once again that we are anxiously awaiting your participation in this discussion, as we are in all of them. And I want to tell you that at 15 after the hour, you can call into the studio by calling area code 646-716-7070. Again, at 15 after the hour, we'd like for you to give us a call at 646-716-7070. And that even includes those folks over in London Town who may be listening to the show.
Absolutely.
So, John, indeed. And you ready to get it underway?
Let's go.
All right.
Let's go.
Let's go get our music guru, Mr. Joyce Chandler, who's also from London.
All right. Welcome, everybody. This is George Chandler, and you're listening to George Talking Music.
Whoa. Oh, mercy, mercy.
You recognize that voice? Of course you do. On tonight's program, we continue with the story of Marvin Gaye, one of the most consistent and enigmatic of the Motown hitmakers. Mm-hmm. Tonight, we focus on the second phase of his career, the years, the 70s and the 80s. In fact, these are the years that would change everything that had gone before.
Yeah, man, you talk about somebody being enigmatic. He was certainly the guy, boy, because he could change.
Yeah, he certainly was a bit of a stubborn kind of fella.
Indeed, indeed. And his background, as you took us through last week, George, is a perfect foundation for understanding how complex and multifaceted this guy's personality ultimately became. And
that's absolutely right. I mean, a lot has happened in the life of Marvin Gaye since he started his career at Motown in 1962. He has had numerous hit records as a solo singer and also as a duet singer with female partners like Mary Wells, Kim Weston, and most of all, with Tammy Terrell. But Marvin is not happy. He wants more control over his career. And because Tammy Terrell can't do live performances anymore because of her illness, you remember in 1967, she collapsed in Marvin's arms and was later diagnosed with a brain tumor.
Yeah,
Marvin came off the road, and he just kind of became a hermit, really. I mean, he was depressed. He really, really missed Tammy Terrell.
Yeah.
And because Tammy couldn't do live performances, Marvin started thinking about producing other artists, and he starts writing and producing the Originals. Now, the Originals were basically the Motown house backing group.
Yeah.
And he wrote, along with his wife Anna, the song Baby I'm For Real, which went to number one on the R&B chart.
Oh, yeah.
And around this time, he had a chance meeting with Rinaldo Obi Benson of the Four Tops, and that meeting really changed everything. But before that, in June of 1970, Motown released the final Marvin Gaye single of the year. And in a way, it kind of speaks of where Marvin's head is at the time. Check out The End of Our Road.
Something happened with me during that period. I felt the strength.
Fill it in later, George. Keep going.
All right. Now, I mentioned earlier about this meeting with Obi Benson and how it changed everything. Obi had witnessed the riots in Berkeley, California, and had come up with a few lyrics and a little bit of music. And he played what he had to Marvin. And Marvin was fascinated by the idea. And he had some lyrics and melody of his own. And with the help of Al Cleveland, they delivered this song to Barry Gordy. And when Barry Gordy heard the song, he said it was the worst song he had ever heard.
Oh.
And so Marvin decided he would go on strike. He said, I'm not going to record another song until this song was released. Finally, Motown decided to release the song. Listen now to the glorious What's Going On. What's Going On? Number one on the R&B chart and number two on the pop chart.
That's a big
hit. Wow.
That's massive.
That was a huge hit. And in fact, you know, there's a a great interview that I discovered, George, with Marvin talking about the work he put into what's going on. Let's have a listen to that real quick, okay?
Okay.
Yeah.
I think it was around 1969 and 1970, about that period, at Motown Records when I stopped thinking so much about my erotic fantasies and I started to think about the war in Vietnam and my brother who told me some pretty horrible stories about the war. At the same time, there was a great deal of unrest in America. The Martin Luther King crusades and the shootings of the kids on the college campuses and I don't know, I sort of saw the country headed for modern-day civil war. Something happened with me during that period. I felt a strong urge to write music and to write lyrics that would touch the souls of men.
Well, yeah, he certainly did that, I'll tell you.
Yes,
because
he did.
What's going on was certainly a music changer.
Yeah. Big time.
Yeah, he certainly touched the hearts of a lot of folks, too, man, because that song became kind of a backdrop for that time period, didn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely. And the album, the What's Going On album, I mean, it just spoke about that particular period that we were living in the 60s and the early 70s. And the way he sang and the way he, the whole feel of the album, we hadn't heard anything like it before. And
yes.
After the single came out, Marvin went back into the studio to finish recording the album, along with the arranger, David Van De Pit. He would produce a masterpiece.
Yes.
Mm.
The follow-up to What's Going On was the single about the planet and the ecology. Check out Mercy, Mercy Me.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north to south and south. Oh, mercy, mercy.
Oh yeah, mercy, mercy me. Number one on the R&B chart, number four on the pop chart, and number 51 on the UK chart.
There you go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. And you can hear, you can feel the similarity in the orchestration and everything, connecting back to sort of what's going on. He had found a groove, hadn't he?
Absolutely. He's working with musicians that he likes, and they want to work with him, and they're working over in Studio B in Detroit, and they are having a ball. And the wonderful thing about these songs on the What's Going On album is that although they were written 46 years ago, they are still valid today.
Yeah.
How about that?
That's true. That's true, because every time my wife and I we have parties here at the house, I think the first LP I put on is What's Going On.
Yeah.
It just livens up the place, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Still it is. Yeah.
Now here's a story from the making of the What's Going On album. There was a guy by the name of James Nix, and he was an old guy and very well dressed gentleman, and he ran the elevator at the company's Woodward Avenue building. And Johnny Bristol said in an interview about him that James, he would hand out his lyrics to anyone who showed the slightest interest. He was completely tone deaf, but that wouldn't stop him from singing them to you.
Yeah.
He was a nice man, but nobody took him seriously. Nobody but Marvin. He took the time to discover that Mr. Nix was an excellent writer of words. And Nix himself said, we started putting some stuff in there about how rough things were around town. We put stuff in this about high taxes, because both of us owed a lot. We talked about how the government was sending guys to the moon, but not help folk in the ghetto.
Yeah,
let's
yeah.
hear now the song that came out of that songwriting session, the beautiful Inner City Blues. Inner City Blues, number one on the R&B chart, and number nine on the pop chart.
Yeah.
Like I said, it could have been written yesterday. Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. And the unfortunate thing over here in the U.S. is that that same tax man they're talking about, who would said before you make it, they take it. Well, it's happened. It's happening double time now, boy.
I'm telling you. I tell you, the lyrics, I mean, this guy, this elderly gentleman, James Nix, I mean, they came up with some wonderful words on this song.
Indeed.
And like I said, this song could have been written yesterday. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
And one of my favorite tracks by Marvin from the What's Going On album is the gospel-inspired God is Love. Check out. God is love.
Oh, don't go and talk about my father.
Talk about my father.
God is my friend.
God is my friend.
He made this world for us to live in.
He made this world
and gave us everything.
God gave us everything.
And all he asks of us is we give each other love.
Oh, yeah, that's all he has, is to give each other love. God, that's a beautiful album track up from the What's Going On album.
Yeah, yeah. You know, throughout his up and down, topsy-turvy kind of life, man, God was always centered in him. It seemed like it was always a struggle between good and evil inside of this guy, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It seemed to have been. I mean, he was... one of the books that was written about Marvin is called Divided Soul. And I think that's very well, because he was always conflicted with what we call the world, and also with the strict upbringing, a Christian upbringing that he had from all of his life, from his young days, from his childhood, really.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, his father being a minister, God was always a part of his life.
Yeah, and George, do you think he was a soul that struggled with believing that folks really and truly loved him?
Marvin, like I said, Marvin is such a divided a personality. I mean, in many respects, Marvin didn't like himself.
Yeah,
he didn't like
yeah.
aspects of his own personality.
Yeah,
you know.
Hmm.
But the thing about it is, for me, the most important thing is, it's because of who he was that he was able to express himself the way he did musically.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if everything had been right in his life and he had no hang-ups and blah blah blah, he couldn't have written lyrics like he did on this album.
Yeah, he wouldn't have felt that. Yeah,
that's right.
He wouldn't be he wouldn't have been confronted with that with that hassle, you know, that mindset thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Now, in 1972, Marvin gets the call to do the music for a new movie that is to be released in 1972. The album will be half instrumental and half vocal. Check out the title track. To Trouble Man.
I didn't make it true, playing by the rules.
title for him, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It certainly does.
Yeah.
I come up hard.
Yeah. You
know
that,
what he's talking about. Know what he's saying
about. You know that period when all these black, what do you call them, black exploitation films were coming out. So I mean that period, I mean, was so wonderful. You had Isaac Hayes with Shaft, you had Curtis Mayfield with Superfly. And Bobby Womack
across
110th
Street. Oh, don't
forget
Bobby Womack with across.
That was amazing.
It was a wonderful period. It was a wonderful period.
Yes, it was.
Tremendous.
1973, we're up to now. And Marvin released the follow-up album to What's Going On. Now, the album was entitled Let's Get It On. And here is the title track, Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On. Look out, Marvin. You can't do that in here. Let's Get It On. Number one on the R&B chart. Number one on the pop chart. And number 31 on the UK chart.
Yes, indeed.
Tremendous song. Tremendous song.
Yes,
and also, you know, he did that out in coordination with a fellow, Ed Townsend, whom I know both of you guys know.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting discussion that Ed gave once to talk about the fact that that song really wasn't intended to go the way Marvin took it. You know, he said, matter of fact, I don't want to say his words. Let's listen to Ed talk about it.
All right.
I had written that song with several things in mind. Marvin could make the Star Spangled Banner sexy. It was his way. But if you listen to it, it opens with, we're all sensitive people with so much to give. Since we gotta be here, let's live. I had written that song really to inspire alcoholics and drug addicts to get on with their lives. And since then, Let's Get It On has been used when somebody gets mad, they say, let's get it on. When they wanna go make love, they say, let's get it on. When the judge goes and opens his judge for meals, let's get it on. When they get ready to box, let's get it on. It became a cliche of a kind, and it was happy, and it was for real. While singing Let's Get It On, Jan had gone to the bathroom, taken her hair out of the pigtails and put on a little lipstick, and suddenly grew to be a young lady instead of a little girl with pigtails. You know how you do that, don't you? And he said, I want to get it on. Which meant he was very serious about seeing Jan. It just wasn't a passing fancy that he really liked her. And so after the session, I said, Marvin, if you want to take her out, you're going to have to go and ask her mother.
Boy, I tell you, a good thing he's not around today, boy. He'd be in big trouble, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
He'd be in big trouble.
That's an interesting insight as to how that song flipped from being a message song to people having difficulties with life to becoming something that folks had children by, you know.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, at the time of its release, an all music writer later called it the most important and passionate record to come out of soul music. In fact,
wow,
the album stayed on the charts for 2 years and sold over 3 million copies.
Yeah. Mm.
And if you notice, Let's Get It On is a completely different album to What's Going On. What's Going On dealt with the war, the ecology, the ghetto, et cetera. Let's Get It On deals strictly with love, sex, and romance.
Mm-hmm.
Check
right.
out sexy. Come get to this. Come here, baby. Come and get to this. Number 3 on the R&B chart, and number 22 on the pop chart, and number 51 on the UK chart.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, wow. I love the accent of those bongos, man. I mean, in the opening of that song.
Yeah. Set it up. Yes, indeed. Marvin was at, I tell you, he was at his peak, I think.
Man, He sure was.
Yeah. It was unbelievable.
I mean, he was so big now in 1973 that Motown decided to go back to the plan that they was using in the 60s with Team and Marvin with their girl singers. And so they decided to team Marvin up with Diana Ross, who was the biggest female artist at Motown.
Mm-hmm.
And they recorded an album called Diana and Marvin, from which they released the single, You're a Special Part of Me. Check it out.
That special tear I shed means you're a part of me. Thoughts of you running through my head means you're a part of me. Yeah, I'm satisfied to know that you're a part of me. What
oh,
I
yeah.
want to say.
Oh, yes, you're a special part of me. Number 4 on the R&B chart, number 12 on the pop chart, and number 51 on the UK chart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's one that didn't, I think we talked about it before, it didn't register with me at the time, but matching the two of them up, I'm sure Barry Gordy was looking at the cash register because they were both.
I think that was basically what it was really about, because at that particular time, Barry Gordy was trying to turn Diana into a movie actress.
Okay.
And when they recorded this album, apparently they didn't record the songs together because Diana resented the fact that Marvin would occasionally start puffing on a joint, you know.
Yeah.
And she was pregnant at the time, and she didn't want to be surrounded by smoke. And so, but I think that was also jealousy between the two of them, because Marvin was huge at this time.
Yeah.
And I think that Diana was very competitive, as you probably know.
Yeah, right. Still is.
That's to say the least.
Yeah.
Anyway, in 1974, Marvin decided to go back on the road again, and you know, and do live gigs, and because, like I said, he stopped recording. He stopped going on the road after Tammy collapsed in his arms in 1967.
Yeah.
And Motown decided to record the concert, which was at the Oakland Alameda County Coliseum.
Mm-hmm.
And they released the results as Marvin Gaye Live, from which came the very beautiful live version of Distant Lover.
But yet artistically to be performing at such a high level.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
I mean, his relations with Motown, I mean, they were continuing to deteriorate.
Yeah.
And the marriage to Anna was finished.
Mm.
And he decided that that his next album would in fact be dedicated to Anna, and she would receive all the royalties from this album.
Mm-hmm.
The album was called Here, My Dear. Check out the track from the album called A Funky Space Reincarnation.
Peace, baby. It's time for the trip up inside my moody ship. I can tell by your way that you really wanna stay. Space, funky space, peaceful space, safe place.
Yeah, funky space reincarnation. They're trying to pick up on the dance group. This is a very strange album, though, because you wonder, and you at the time, you wonder, does Motown really want this album to be successful? Because they
yeah.
didn't really push it with confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I bought the album, and the album has some wonderful tracks on it, some really fantastic tracks on it.
Yeah,
it
sure
but did. Like I said, this relationship with Motown is deteriorating so bad till it won't be long before Marvin's going to be out of here.
Okay, well, let me jump
you
in
know.
Here a little bit and just kind of ask you with regards to his relationship with Anna and with his relationship with his time in England, which we've kind of skipped over a couple of times.
No,
I
we
really
haven't got
like...
to it yet.
Oh,
we
I
haven't
see.
Got to
okay.
it yet. It was
well,
later on in the 80s when Marvin moved to England. And I am
okay.
going to talk about it.
Okay, while we're at this stage, let me just introduce a little side trip on the Underground Railroad. And,
all right.
And when we come back, if you could just speak to the issue around his relationship with Anna and that album, because he had a couple of options, right? He could get caught up with his back alimony payments or figure out another way to make it work. And then what did she really get out of it, I guess, is what I'd be interested in. So to our listening audience, don't go away. We'll be right back.
Next up,
okay.
Beecher Hall at Illinois College. Beecher Hall, the original building of Illinois College, is the oldest college building in the state. Construction of the south half, the original portion of the present two-story brick structure, began in the summer of 1829 and was completed in 1830. Illinois College had close ties with the abolitionist movement and the Underground Railroad from its inception. Its classrooms and residential quarters provided safe places to deplore slavery, strategize means for ending slavery, and to assist freedom seekers passing through Jacksonville. The college was founded by local trustees and 7 graduates of the Yale Theological Department, all opposed to slavery. Its first college president, Beecher, and 2 college trustees helped found the Illinois Anti-Slavery Society in 1837. Beecher Hall, Illinois College, is located at 1101 West College Avenue, Jacksonville, Illinois. The campus is free and open to visitors during operating hours, and tours are available.
Okay, we're back now, and for our listening audience, just to give you a living example of when you're talking with a music guru, that you should sit back and listen rather than try to invoke something that you haven't gotten to yet. So my apologies for attempting to do that. And,
yeah.
and I appreciate bringing it back on track, George. So where are we now?
Well, we're in 1980. Now, in 1980, Marvin went on a European tour. And by the time the tour stopped, he decided to relocate to London. And now, the reasons why he was trying to get away from the States, he feared imprisonment for failure to pay back taxes, which had now reached upwards to $4.5 million.
Ooh.
Now, he spent much of 1980 recording in London the album, which was going to be his final album with Motown, called In Our Lifetime. And but something happened. Somebody stole a master tape of a rough draft of the album and took it to Motown. And Motown remixed the album and released it without Marvin's consent. Marvin was livid, and he vowed not to record any more music for Motown. In fact, of that album, In Our Lifetime, there were no major hits from this album. And Marvin now decided, and Gordy also decided, to let Marvin go. And he moved to Columbia, and he would finish his career at Columbia.
Wow, that's incredible.
Before you ask a good question, though, you ask a question about Anna, and Anna and Marvin had a very, very rocky relationship. They argued, they hit each other. Anna encouraged Marvin's creativity. In fact, like I mentioned earlier, in 1969, it was her and Marvin who wrote the songs that for the group The Originals.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and so she was, but they just had one of those relationships, the highly combustible relationships, you know. And
right.
So he was behind on alimony payments, and so they decided, well, we'll record this album. All the royalties from this album will go to you for your back alimony payments and blah, 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 like that. And
right,
that's how
right.
the album Here, My Dear came to be.
Yeah, I love the title, Here, My Dear.
It's all yours.
Yeah, right. And I understand the soul about
Have it all.
I understand.
Now, in 1981, Marvin was being promoted by a Belgian promoter by the name of Freddy Cossette.
Yeah.
And in February, he advised Marvin to move from London to Belgium.
That's right.
And while living in Ostend, Belgium, Marvin stayed away from heavy drug use. And he began exercising, and he started attending a local church in Austin. And he began working on the album that would be called Midnight Love. Now, the first single was written and recorded in his Austin apartment. Hear now that first single called Sexual Healing.
When I get that
Sexual Healing, number one on the R&B chart, number three on the pop chart, number 12 on the dance chart, and number four on the UK chart.
That's a great song.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. In fact, Mary Wilson was doing a tour in that area where Marvin was staying in the Netherlands, and she had a comment about how he rolled it out to her. Let's listen to that.
I was doing a tour, and I called Marvin. I called him from the airport. I said, I'm in town. He said, oh, baby, come on over. And then he said, I got something I want you to hear. And I said, okay. And he put on Sexual Healing. And he says, what you think, baby? I'm like, Marvin, that is brilliant. He says, are you sure you think they're going to like it? I'm like, they're going to love it. And he was so unsure of that.
That's and I guess that's an attitude of most artists, right, John? That even the ones that are really great, there's always this uncertainty about acceptance, isn't it?
Oh yeah, of course it is. Yeah, I mean you're always critical of the work that you do, you know. You never like it, you know. Sometimes even when it becomes hits, you don't like it, you know. You say, well, they like it, good. it sounds like a hit, but I don't like it.
Right.
Now, Sexual Healing became Marvin's biggest career hit, spending a record 10 weeks at number one on the Hot Black Singles chart. According to Billboard statistics, it was the biggest R&B hit of the 80s. Eventually, selling over 6 million copies worldwide.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Marvin.
Go ahead, Marvin. That's a good way to put it.
Oh, yeah. Now, one of my favorite tracks from the album Midnight Love is the very lovely My Love Is Waiting. Let's have a little bit of that. My Love Is Waiting. Now I'm going to tell you why I love this song so much. I love this track because one of the great pleasures of listening to Marvin's records after what's going on in particular is the wonderful job he does singing the backing voices.
Yeah. Well, of course.
And that song, My Love Is Waiting, is just like, oh, he's having so much fun on that.
Yeah.
I mean, with those back voices.
Yeah.
They're just lovely.
Yeah.
And the other thing about, I must say, about the Sexual Healing album is that he's back. Well, he's not really back because he's always been there. This album is produced by Harvey Fuqua.
Uh-huh.
Harvey Fuqua. It was Harvey Fuqua who took Marvin to Detroit.
That's right.
And Harvey Fuqua has been in Marvin's career all the way. He was doing Marvin's early career in the 60s. He was producing some of the songs with Tammy Terrell.
Yeah.
He was producing other. So he's been there all along.
Did he work with Freddie on that album? The Sexual Healing album. Did he work on that album also?
Harvey Fuqua, yes, indeed.
Yeah, because it's really funny because you know Freddie used to book us, you know, because he was a booking agent, and we used to spend half the work that we had was in Belgium and Holland, you know. So we used to work with Freddie, you know.
Yeah,
he's a very, very, very nice guy, Freddie. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
he was very, very good. He was very, very good for Marvin.
Because
when Marvin was in London, he was doing lots and lots of drugs.
Oh, yeah, with nothing happening here.
And I refused to go meet him because I didn't really want to be a part of that.
No,
me
either. Yeah.
And when he moved to Belgium, he got away from that crowd, and Freddie kept him away from those people as well as he could.
He was
a
good guy,
and Marvin started doing exercising and getting his body back in shape, you know. And Harvey came and joined him, and they got together, and they put together the album Midnight Love, from which comes Sexual Healing.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Fantastic.
Let's talk about one thing I'd like to talk about is Marvin's influence. And Marvin said that his main influence was his minister father. He acknowledges this in loads of interviews, mentioning that his father's sermons greatly impressed him. Now, that was his main influence. His musical influences was doo-wop groups. And one of his main influences was Rudy West, who was the lead singer of the Five Keys.
My hero.
Yes, indeed.
My
and
hero.
Clyde McFadden, Ray Charles, and Little Willie John.
Yeah.
Little Willie John.
Yeah, and he
wow.
was influenced by the vocal style of Billy Eckstine and Nat King Cole.
Yeah.
Now, here's something that I didn't know, that during his years at Motown, he was very much influenced by David Ruffin of the Temptations and Levi Stubb of the Four Tops. And they used to talk, you know, music together, you know, vocally. And he was very influenced by them because they had a roughness, a gruffness to their voice, and which Marvin was trying to develop in his own. And he said himself, Marvin said, I heard something in their voices, something that my own voice lacked.
Yeah.
And it was the manliness in their voices that he liked.
Wow. And millions of others.
Yes. All right. Yeah. Now we
That's
move
great.
Into 1983. On February 13th, 1983, Marvin sang the national anthem at the NBA All-Star Game at the Forum in Inglewood, California. The following month, he performed at the Motown 25 Yesterday, Today, Forever special.
Yeah.
And then he went out on the road on a tour called the Sexual Healing Tour. And that started in April of 1983. And the tour ended in August of 1983. And then Marvin decided to move into his parents' house.
Fatal mistake.
Fatal mistake. He moves in, he makes that happens. Makes that decision in August. And the following April, after he and his father became involved in a physical altercation, his father shot him 2 times. Once in the heart and once in the shoulder.
I'm telling you.
The first shot proved to be fatal. It happened 1 day short of his 45th birthday.
Yeah, a young guy like that.
His father was charged with first-degree murder. His charges were dropped to voluntary manslaughter following a diagnosis of a brain tumor. And they did an autopsy on Marvin Gaye, and it revealed that the singer had drugs in his system. He was eventually, his father, sentenced to a suspended 6-year sentence and probation. And he died in a nursing home in 1998.
Amazing. You know, one report on the death of Marvin had a lot to do with the fact that that the emergency services people couldn't get into the house because the police prevented them from getting in for almost 30 minutes because they weren't sure where the dad was and where the gun was. But when they found Marvin, in his, I think it was his right hand, he was holding a cross. So at the time of the shooting, because you know he went down as they described it pretty suddenly, he had a cross in his hand. He was talk about being torn right up to the end. This guy was that way. Let me ask you guys, do you remember the day that news broke and how did it affect you?
I'll tell you. Can I tell you first? I was in, this was the second time that that a great singer friend a fan of mine had died. And I'm always in the barbershop, so I get my hair fixed. When Otis Redding got killed, I was getting my hair processed in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And then Marvin died. I was in Sweden. I was in a hairdresser shop getting rollers put in my hair, right? I had this long hair, you know. And
right.
she put hair to rollers in my hair. And then one of the guys on the radio said, Marvin Gaye, Mort, in Swedish. And she screamed and she ran out the shop. So I'm sitting in the shop for one hour and a half, nobody's around. So I'm sitting there with hip rolls in my hair. So some guy comes in and they say, oh, yeah, look, I'm sorry. She's upset. What happened? So Marvin Gaye died. And the night before, at a party, we were playing If I Should Die, Marvin Gaye, If I Should Die.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so finally,
yeah.
Anyway, to make a long story short, I finally got my hair finished. They put the other rollers in there. Somebody else did. But it was, I couldn't believe that. You know, I said, no.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I was on tour with James Lass.
Mm-hmm.
And we were actually in Germany when the news came. And it was really a shock. And to find out that it was his father.
Yeah.
Who killed his own son. You know, really, really sad. And some people have speculated that that was Marvin's way of committing suicide.
Yeah, that's what I believe too, Joyce. I mean,
because
he had been
threatening suicide for the many years.
Yeah,
you know, because sometimes he'd get depressed, you know, and
right.
I think he knew that the relationship with him and his father wasn't no good, and apparently.
Yep.
He really did give his father a hell of a beating, and they found all kinds of welt marks all over his father.
Yeah.
From the beating
and
that Marvin had given him.
And also, George, his sister said that his father, throughout the years that they were battling in that house when Marvin moved back, had promised him that if he ever put his hands on him, that I brought you into this world, boy. And I'll take you out.
Mm.
And so that whole scene played out. And Marvin knew that. And because the gun that he shot him with, Marvin gave it to him. And also, let's listen to how Smokey dealt with it.
I was driving home, listening to the radio. And the disc jockey interrupted the program to say soul singer. I know, I hear it in my mind like it happened today. Soul singer Marvin Gaye was pronounced dead on arrival at the hospital. So now I don't buy this. My heart, my innards won't let me accept this. So I get out of my car. There's a phone booth right there. And I go to the phone and I call Anna. And I say, Anna, this is Smoke. She said, yeah, baby. I didn't even have to ask her. She said, yeah, baby, it's true. His dad shot him. What?
Just unbelievable. Absolutely
unbelievable.
Unbelievable. And all of his fans felt that same way. Just shocked, man.
Of course.
But his voice didn't. Motown didn't allow his voice to be unheard, did they, George?
Of course not. In the future years, they would release different combinations of Marvin Gaye's CDs. And but in 1985, Columbia, because Marvin is signed to Columbia. They decided to release their final single on Marvin Gaye. And have a listen to the wonderful Sanctified Lady. Thank you. Hot Lady. Marvin still got it. That's number two on the R&B chart.
Wow.
Yes, indeed. The pop chart didn't make that much difference. It only got to 101 on the pop chart. And,
okay.
But it got to number 47 on the dance chart and
yeah.
number 51 on the UK chart.
Wow. Yeah. Had a great rhythm to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it also just carried completely that theme of you know, the twist between good and evil inside of humanity that he carried with him all the way, man. Because he's talking about
yep.
sanctified lady. Some
mm-hmm.
say yes, some
mm-hmm.
say no.
Yeah, I mean, I think that throughout Marvin's career, especially after he started from What's Going On, when he let his writing abilities come to the fore,
okay.
because at Motown he wasn't encouraged to write.
Yeah,
the artists were encouraged to sing, and that's all.
Yeah,
they had a writing staff.
Right.
So this is a machine.
Right.
This Motown thing is a machine.
Yeah.
Just like making a car. That's how Barry Gordy organized it. Every person has their job, and the artists, they just filled in a spot, just like, you know, screwing on the fender of a car.
Yeah. Because it's
right.
not true at Motown. That's,
yeah,
you know,
that's
true.
And Marvin hated that. He was having hits in the '60s. And but he didn't get no encouragement. Anytime he tried to step forward and write, they would find some kind of way to not let it get past quality control.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kept Marvin doing songs by Holland Dozier Holland, kept him doing songs by Norman Whitfield.
Yeah, and Johnny Bristol.
But these songs
yeah.
were hits, though. He was still
yeah.
having hits, but he wasn't
oh, yeah.
really expressing what he wanted to express until
right.
he got to What's Going On.
Yeah.
And once he got
yeah.
What's Going On, from then on, you can hear his music just talk about what he wants to talk about, and always there's that feeling of love in his music.
Yeah.
Even if he's
yeah.
talking about bad things, you know, like he does on Makes Me Wanna Holler.
Right, right.
You can still hear the love in his voice.
Yeah, you sure can. Sure can. How about recognition, George? Did he get? Was he properly recognized doing for his
He has been recognized quite a lot, in fact, here. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1987. And in 1990, he got a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah. 1996, he got a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. Posthumously. And the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame listed 3 Marvin Gaye recordings among its list of 500 songs that shaped rock and roll. And those 3 songs were I Heard It Through the Grapevine, What's Going On, and Sexual Healing.
Wow.
Rolling Stone ranked Marvin number 18 on their list of the 100 greatest artists of all time.
Wow.
And
wow.
number 6 on their list of 100 greatest singers of all time.
Number 6.
Good.
Q Magazine ranked a number 6 on their list of 100 greatest singers. Oh, and the Rhythm and Blues Music Hall of Fame. Finally, elected him. And also in 2016, he was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame.
Oh, beautiful. Well, you snatched that rhythm and blues question right out of my mouth.
I know it. It was coming.
It was nice to get it a yes, though.
Right.
Yeah, it was coming.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I tell you, God, you got anything else you can squeeze out of this, man? Because this is rich.
Yeah, well, I would just very briefly say that Marvin Gaye redefined the way soul music was created during the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
His work not only redefined soul music as a creative force, but also expanded its impact as an agent for social change.
That's
true. Beautiful, man. However,
if you listen to the albums back in the day when What's Going On came out, and you wouldn't think about he's talking about the earth ecology stuff like that, or everything, because we would look at that thing. It was great love songs. We thought everything was a love song. So he said, "What's going on with the world?" We ain't listening to that. We just say, "What's going on?"
Yeah.
I mean, if you ask somebody today, was Marvin Gaye involved in social change? They said no. He did love albums, but What's Going On wasn't a love album.
That's right. Well, you know, as we've seen so far, his whole the second part of his life was spent on putting forth in the marketplace Marvin Gaye, not Motown, and and he successfully did that. I tell you, man.
Yes. Once he started from What's Going On, he became a unique soul artist. He no longer sounded like somebody off the Motown conveyor belt.
That's right.
He showed that it could be done, Stevie Wonder did the same thing.
Sure did.
But Marvin had opened the door.
That's a very vivid way to put it, George. Off of the Motown conveyor belt. That's great.
Yeah.
It was
a conveyor belt. But now let me tell you, it was a conveyor belt, but it worked.
It worked.
It certainly did work.
Because I remember when Gladys Knight, we used to hang out, right? Everybody, they would put out, Holland Dozier Holland would make a song, and about five groups used to sing it. Gladys Knight would sing a version of it. The Falcons would sing a version of it. The Contours would sing a version of it. And
that's
when
that
one sounded better, they put that one out. So all the songs were in the same key.
That was a lot of that was especially with Gladys Knight and the Temptations, and of course because they were all produced during this period by Norman Whitfield, and the songs were written by Norman and Barrett Strong. You know that was their job.
And they
would Gladys Knight did a version of I Wish It Would Rain.
Mm-hmm.
Temptation did a version of I Wish It Would Rain.
Yeah.
A whole gang of other ones probably did a version of I Wish It Would Rain. Wouldn't surprise me if the originals didn't do a version.
Because I remember when Jimmy Ruffin, we was hanging out one night, and he was telling me, he said, when he did What Becomes of the Broken Hearted, Gladys Knight, Diana Ross walking into the studio, she said, "That's a nice song. Whose song is that?" "We don't want to talk about it." "No, whose song is it?" So you went, "Barry, whose song is that?" "That's Jimmy Ruffin. I want that." He said, "Oh, no, my God, this is my hit." He said, "That's my hit gone." He said, "No, Mr. Gordy, please don't do that."
Wow.
He said, "Please don't get Oh, funny. So funny.
Yeah, but you know, that just shows you the brilliance of those guys during that time, because the general public, I mean, I never thought about the fact that they were just recycling the same songs throughout five or six different groups. Never thought about that.
Yeah, they did. That's what they did.
Yeah.
And like we said, it worked.
Yeah.
I mean, because even though these songwriters were the same, Martha and the Vandellas did not sound like the Supremes.
Right, right.
You see, so there was a difference. The tracks had that same uniqueness, but the vocals, you didn't ever think that a record by The Supremes was a record by Martha and the Vandellas.
Or the Marvelettes. They sound different.
I mean, they all were distinct groups.
They were the tops.
So, you know,
That's right.
They were all distinct groups inside that factory.
Mm.
They were able to still make them distinct.
Yeah, it was brilliant, man. I'm telling you. Yeah, brilliant. Well, that's great, man. Well, I think, man, we have we've packaged two parts of first of all, a wonderful life and a great artist. But you've allowed it to be filled, George, with just great anecdotes and great true life episodes from Marvin Gaye and even a lot of other people around him. And man, I just want to my thank you to you for doing that. Okay.
Yes, it's been my pleasure as always. You know, Marvin Gaye, like I said, was one of my favorite artists, and especially. From the What's Going On period. And very unique.
Yeah.
John, you were trying to say something?
No, I was just saying that, you know, when you get people like, you know, we used to always talk about all the great soul singers back in the day were all guys with high voices, Clyde McFadden and the Jackie Wilsons and the Willie Johns. Marvin Gaye had a high voice, you know. And he was able to go up and down that falsetto like it was amazing, like it was like an accordion. He just went up and down. It was a totally amazing voice he had. You know what I mean? And it's very hard for another singer, right, to implement that. So you might be able to copy Luther Vandross. It's going to be very hard to copy Marvin Gaye. You know?
Yeah,
really
indeed.
Hard.
Mm. That's probably why he's number six on the all-time greatest singer list.
Exactly. He was very important to the business.
Yeah. Well, all right, guys. Well, I guess having said all of that, George, and with us giving you the appreciation that we honestly have for the work you put into it, it seems like there's only one thing left for us to do. What is that, guys?
Well. Okay, well,
bye-bye.
Okay, the conductor is telling us it's time to move on. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Let us know by sending an email to info@clioexchange-express.com. That's info@clioexchange-express.com. Until next time, we wish you peace of mind, love from the heart, and happiness you cannot explain.